at sapping the mental strength of the Saigon government, of the Americans, or had military importance. What I didn't see in Vietnam was a see him and shoot him, an indiscriminate violence, like I think we saw in Rwanda, like, you know, you're just a Tutsi and you die, or elsewhere. I'm not that good a student in history.
Yeah, yeah.
It was subtle. It was generally restrained.
By the Viet Cong side. Okay.
Except for the instance of terrorism. Now, when they blew up buses going between Hue and Vietnam,
and it could be anybody.
I was behind one bus. Okay, I took some of the first casualties there. I saw people in pieces and so on. That was my first baptism into fire. And we had students at the high school in Quang Tri who died in mine accidents. I never could understand. That seemed random. I couldn't see how that fit in anybody's program.
Right.
Because anybody who would suffer from that would automatically hold the Viet Cong responsible.
Maybe it wasn't Viet Cong then.
Maybe not be, but my understanding then and still now is it probably was.
Okay.
It was basically to say, okay, we're out there, okay, you're going to have to listen to us. You cannot move around freely without consequences. And
okay.
You can read stories of unmitigated Viet Cong violence. The book by Lely Hayslip, okay, When Heaven and Earth Change Place,
mm-hmm.
gives a couple instances of just wanton cruelty.
Yeah.
So, I seem to see a pattern. I was not singled out and didn't see slaughters like that committed by the side. You know, other people probably did. And
yeah.
If you talk to some Vietnamese who come over here, they'll have stories and so on.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess what I'm saying is,
with
I
an
saw
active war for
and,
so long, it's going to happen somewhere, sometime.
And there's a lot that I didn't see.
Yeah.
So, I can't argue against somebody else's experience if they say.
Oh no. Yeah. That's always a losing battle.
Yeah.
You know, because then it's I think this. Well, I think that. Well, then. It's each blind man with a different part of the elephant.
Yeah. We don't have social scientists over there doing careful surveys and
careful data. As if that always tells you anything. But let me get back to a little bit more of the mundane.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's actually almost a downer. But I'm interested in, because you described the Delta in such almost serene terms. At least your own perception of the physical geography,
right.
No matter what might have been going on
in
the war time.
It was God's country.
Yeah. And in a sense, as a kind and sort of gentle, I hate to say the kinder and gentler, but...
South Vietnam, the South Vietnamese and so on.
But even the relationship between the local forces and the NLF, bouncing up and dancing with each other so that neither one suffered.
I'm not sure. That certainly happened where I was.
Yeah.
I didn't hear from any other IVSs that it necessarily happened elsewhere.
Okay. But at least in this one, I'm dealing with your experience. And so I was wondering, this meant that your life really wasn't impacted directly, other than being watched and observed.
And
but on a daily basis, you didn't really have to... It seemed like the war wasn't really with a gun directly to your head, although it was like
it
in
was,
the area.
It was gentle. I was able to relax there where I couldn't elsewhere.
Nonetheless, that was the impression I was getting, but I wanted
possession.
To come to this to understand it.
That said, we had to make sure that we didn't travel, outside of dark.
Okay.
You just had to travel well-traveled roads.
Yeah.
Circumspect and didn't. And you asked people, well, is it okay to go here and go there? And they
you didn't do anything stupid.
Right.
You told people where you were going.
And one of the casualties IVS occurred in the Delta.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If I can get that guy's name, his name will come. David somebody was killed Anyang province and so on. He was kind of, anyway, you should maybe note that down and try to get there. Dave Gittleson.
Dave Gittleson?
Was shot. Okay. And there's some
question
who did
that name. I've heard that name because I think Frank was talking about that yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that there were questions about a couple of deaths.
Well, that's the next point of the question, which side could it come from?
Which side could have, and he was saying that there was speculation that it could have been even our side.
Because he was in a position where he was talking to, if not Kennedy himself, at least the people from his office who were trying to find out what was happening in the war. And
what year was that? This, you mean Bobby Kennedy?
No, this is Ted Kennedy. He was a senator by then.
Okay, all right.
He was leading an opponent against the war, and had, he was in charge of refugees. And so he used to come to Vietnam periodically to check out the status of refugees and, you know, to what extent we were responsible for making refugees and taking care of them.
And so, forced urbanization, and what was that doing to the society?
Yeah.
Okay.
And,
so Gittleson might have been a contact person.
He was somebody who would have been in a position either to talk to Kennedy or his men and to give a rather unflattering view of what America was doing and what the Saigon government was doing.
I don't know if that would be enough reason to kill him. Enough reason maybe to get him transferred and to, you know, put some heat on IVS through AID to shift him to some other part of the country or back home.
If there are people of goodwill.
Whether if there are people who would do it.
Of goodwill, yeah. Or whether they just simply, you're out. He was also in a rather remote area. I mean, he was not living in the city, he was living out central, where he may have been going and coming. It was just simply, it was doable, you know. It was doable.
And so it could
as
have also been
to being
an accident.
In the city, as opposed to being, you know, sitting there in the IVS compound in the middle of Saigon, you know, it
right.
would be a little more difficult for the
assassin. It would have to look, it would have to really be assassination, and it would instantly be seen that way.
He couldn't be harder to pin it on, or let assumptions pin it on the Viet Cong.
Well, did could it have been an accident? Could it have been that he just didn't tell someone he was going somewhere, tore off, and then
with the
got
passage
into
of time and the lack of detail, it could have been. I can't say another.
Yeah.
But I know at that time questions were raised that it might not have been the Viet Cong, but somebody who disagreed with his politics, and it was easy.
Because he was outspoken.
Outspoken in that he spoke out. He was not a flamboyant, highly verbal person, but he told a story.
He didn't do the posturing, but he was working quietly.
Yeah.
Because almost like a fellow who did survive, Fred Branfman, who was up in Laos and actively helping journalists and things like that. So this Gittleson might have been.
I met Fred. Fred is flamboyant, outspoken to the max, in your face kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Dave was nothing of that.
But doing the same sort of thing,
perhaps. Probably much less. Dave didn't often go out of his area. We hardly ever saw him in Saigon. So he was kind of his local area. And if somebody was going to get some information from him, they probably would have been down to where he was.
And
so on.
It just surprises me that Branfman survives, this guy doesn't.
Yeah. Maybe Branfman, I don't know, you'd have to
luck
in your position.
Luck, maybe. luck of one
or
guy.
Or maybe,
Maybe
difference between the Pathet Lao and the Viet Cong. Or Pathet Lao or the Vietnamese and, you know, the nationalists. Just I can only raise questions. I don't know.
Yeah.
This is something you might. Now, the guy to talk to about that, if you ever get to meet him, is Roger Montgomery.
Roger Montgomery.
Cornell grad. I'm sure he's got a PhD. He's teaching somewhere. He went down to pick up Dave Gittleson's body and bring it back.
Hmm.
And he told some stories in which have faded in my memory.
Okay.
Another person to talk to in Washington, D.C., for this story and for anything else, is a guy named Bob Minnick.
Bob
Minnick, M-I-N-N-I-C-H. He went to
M-I-N-N-I-C-H. I-C-H. I think I remember that name from the list.
He's bright, he's observant, he spent 4 years out like myself. Well, worth your time.
Okay.
I'm trying to look him up this summer.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Well,
another guy up in that area who was a personal friend of mine, Yung Chang Lai, a Taiwanese volunteer.
Y-U-N-G?
Y-U-N-G, C-H-A-N-L-A-I.
C-H-A-N-L-A-I.
Lai is his last name, and Yung Chang is his given name.
Yeah.
Basically, you say Lai Yung Chang if you're Chinese.
And you know where he is? Or
I have his address. He has his own farm growing mushrooms in Pennsylvania. I can give you an address.
You might have to, because, you know, I've been looking through the list, and Minich looks familiar.
Yeah.
Montgomery may or may not be, but Yung Chang Lai, I would remember that if it was on the list. I don't think it is, so I'd appreciate that address.
Another guy, kind of IVS firebrand, who, if you want the story on relations with IVS to USAID, you know, very bright Yale graduate, okay, kind of in-your-face confrontational guy, Mark Lynch.
Mark Lynch.
Mark Lynch, yeah. He's now, he came back, went to law school, and had some really high-profile cases there. He was defending this Vietnamese chap who was, what's his name? I forget, but he was tried for treason, so on, and it was a big case back in the early 70s and so on.
Okay.
Mark Lynch, I'm sure.
Where would he be living?
I think he's probably still in the Washington area.
Oh, Washington, D.C.
Yeah,
area. Okay.
I guess.
Okay.
And the IVS would probably have a coronet or something. He's high profile.
Okay. All righty. No, this is great. And Yung Chen Lai would be, what would be his strong point if Mark Lynch was good on the IVS AID?
Agriculture.
On agriculture in general?
And animal husbandry.
Okay.
He was a technician. He was a good technician.
Okay.
Me, I was a generalist.
Mm-hmm.
I could speak the language, I could find people and bring them down there, and so on. But Yung Chen Lai, he is remembered in this village where I was, Futon Village.
Mm-hmm.
He introduced the rice varieties you saw in the Philippines.
Yeah.
He introduced mushrooms. They're growing mushrooms big time, making a lot of money on that.
Even today?
Even today.
Wow.
Okay. And he was Chinese, and so he was able to have speak directly in Chinese to some of those Chinese I told you about who
lived
in this Futon Village.
Uh-huh,
they could speak basically the dialect of Fujian Province, which is similar to the Taiwan dialect.
Mm-hmm.
And so on.
Close enough.
Remember hearing zzzz, oh, that sounds so cool. And all he could tell, sir, if you meet him, he can tell such great stories. A real raconteur.
Were there any?
Chiang Kai-shek. Get him to tell about Chiang Kai-shek.
And they'll go off.
They'll go off. Because he met the guy. He probably shook his hands back then. And here he was in Taiwan, in Vietnam, the Delta Vietnam, in Sub Trang. He was telling stories that he would get lynched for in Taiwan.
Yeah.
I mean, Chiang Kai-shek, you know Chinese history, what was that?
Yeah.
Not too swift.
But, let's see. Were there any Choms in the area?
No, okay, for Choms, okay, another guy, what's his name? Let me get his name back here. He went on to become a very bright guy, a lot of smart guys in IVS, a lot of smart guys. Oh, it was.
Yeah, this is a hell of a good list of names.
Yeah.
What, to get to your own work though, as work.
Mm-hmm.
What were you promoting mostly in terms?
I'll do it station by station. Okay. Worksite by worksite.
Okay.
When I was in Quang Tri.
Yeah.
I sort of plunked down there, nominally working with refugees, and
uh-huh.
I started out by simply following the USAID people around, and they were very cordial in that, and I had no
the
problem.
The AID group.
AID people.
Yeah.
I had no problem with them individually. They respected me, and I them. If I had to go out of my way to be critical, I'd say that they lived in compounds. They didn't learn the language.
Yeah.
But
that was typical almost anywhere they were.
Yeah.
And they're switched around so often.
And,
how could they?
You know, they were. They were cynical in how their own system failed them. Okay, so I guess that's what I remember. If I had to generalize about them, that's how
yeah.
I'd do it. But anyway, they helped me look at the refugee situation, and there were a lot of them in Quang Tri provinces.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
And I basically visited them, saw that in the villages they had little to do but to. You know, trying to find some work on a nearby base. The Marines are building up there in Dong Ha, in, and there are some jobs there. But most of them just simply killing time in the villages, not doing anything. In the refugee villages,
yeah.
Okay, which are always in the sand, and very, very poor land. So I had to come up with some ideas on handicraft projects or gardening projects and so on. And I may have gone out there and distributed some tools and distributed some seeds, but I basically didn't get very much done before security got so bad they had to evacuate.
Yeah.
So I was up there basically educating myself,
mm-hmm.
witnessing without getting a whole lot done. In the city itself, in Quang Tri City itself, which no longer exists, just bombed off the earth, I met a lot of people. I taught English and learned a lot of language, and this first interpreter had a lot of time spent with him and got oriented. But as far as being able to show, project started, project completed, things accomplished, there wasn't any of that. It's just there, too short a time.
Yeah,
the conditions
yeah.
are so
oh,
difficult.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's where the war was heaviest. I was visiting a neighboring town, Dong Ha. When I came back the next day, I found that Quang Tri had been raided the night before. And I went, you know, got pictures of some of the bodies there. So at that point, it was beginning to get pretty hairy. So I got a cable, get out of there, come back to Saigon. My next real assignment was down in the Delta, in Futong Village. Okay. I got there kind of a period of observing, you know, learning language. I did some English teaching, but pretty soon, okay, they had one product for me to chew on. They had, on their own initiative, quite unique among the villages of the Delta, on their own, because they could cooperate so well,
mm-hmm.
okay, which most Vietnamese villages could not. They were able to get contributions. They bought a French generator, organized a cooperative, a Hợp tác xã Điện lực, an electrical cooperative. And so from dusk until about 10 o'clock, they had lights. And then in the morning from about 5 until sun up, they had lights.
Mm-hmm.
And allowed a night life and early morning life that would not otherwise be possible. And they had each one bulb, one fluorescent bulb, and they paid a flat rate and worked out well. And they had that for at least 10 years or so before I came there. But the French equipment was wearing down. Anyway, we get some more. And they know the Americans had this
tons of
equipment, and maybe some of it was junk. Well, I had before then been to this American base outside of Saigon, where all the materials have been thrown away. So I was able to run through the maze of USAID in Saigon, and they were very cooperative in this, and was able to get permission to go on that base, go to the this huge field of castaway equipment, and point to something, and then arrange to have it given to us. And so we got three Japanese-made 100-kilowatt generators.
Mm-hmm.
It took two trucks, maybe one in each truck, three truckloads. They haul those things down to Futong, and then they cannibalize it and got two machines set side by side. One would go down, the other one could,
the other one could
up
kick
there.
In. Yeah.
And they were very grateful for that.
Oh, yeah.
Very grateful for that. And I was just a gopher. Okay.
Well, but you were instrumental.
I was happy to be a gopher.
No one else could have done it.
They were pleased.
Yeah.
It's interesting, some of the stereotypes about America, Japanese, and French came out. The French made something that lasted a long time. The Americans made a very powerful machine, very extravagant on fuel, but fairly well made. They were always enamored with Japanese equipment, Japanese power tillers, Japanese generators, because they were smaller and they were a whole lot cheaper and just kind of appropriate technology.
Yeah.
And I went back to this time and they said, it'd be nice if we could get rid of that embargo, because the tools we get from the Soviet Union are lousy.
Yeah.
Ball bearings in particular. If you just get American ball bearings and Japanese ball bearings, that'd be really good. Just, you know, in this whole idea of, you know, knowing what comes in from other countries, evaluating the quality.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So that project of getting was good. I also helped this Yung Cheng Lai a little bit with the extension of IR-8, one of the early varieties, rice varieties.
I was already onto IR-5, I think.
Yeah. I went out and I did more looking on actual help in the mushroom project. And I had done a little bit of gophering one time when a helicopter had gone by, shot up a house in the village where I was, and one of the lady had a couple of rounds to her leg, and she was in the hospital. And, and basically, I was asked to approach the American provincial, I'd say American province chief. What was his name? He was the head director of MACV, or what was an acronym there? What's that called? CORE.
Okay.
CORE. The CORE coordinator of Boswellian province. And this guy tried to dismiss it, basically says, well, it wasn't an American helicopter, or if it was there, then there was an enemy in the area, and of course no enemy in the area. And
there was nothing in the area.
He was sufficiently high up to be an asshole.
Yeah.
Lower level Americans are, are decent human beings, and except for one crazy guy named Steve Shepley, who was the son of the editor of Newsweek magazine, and there were questions on his sexual orientation, questions on his use of substance, and
he was military, and what rank?
Probably, no, he was fairly young. He was probably just a little older than I am, and he was up there organizing this Phoenix Project. That was his thing.
Oh, wouldn't he?
He was a spook. He was CIA, and he had his Bronco and his antenna there. That was spookmobile. Okay, and he had these native Cambodians in there who could be influenced to go out and wipe out any little Vietnamese that they wanted to wipe out, and that was pretty
more than
sinister.
Happy to do it.
Pretty sinister. This guy was weird, and his project was you know, beyond weird. It was pernicious. It was evil, and him and this Nick Thorne, the USA director, were people I was glad not to spend a whole lot of time with.
Mm-hmm.
Other people were pretty cooperative.
Yeah. It's amazing that Phoenix program even existed. I mean, it was almost a program designed for wackos.
Yeah. And he would be in there in his chapeau, and he'd be sitting there swaggering back and forth, and he'd have, you know, a big weapon on there, and he probably had an M16 he'd carry on his shoulder, and he'd be giving his orders in French.
Sounds like straight out of Apocalypse Now or something like that.
It's bizarre.
But no, I just saw that IBS, or not IBS, but the Phoenix guy, and I said, it, you know, from everything I had heard.
Ask these guys about Steve Shepler, they know him.
Okay. All of these guys?
Minnickler, because he showed up. And also, if you want some insight, you know, Paul Venn?
Oh, let's ask about...
Paul Venn?
No, Steve Shepler.
Steve Shepler, yeah.
Steve Shepler.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Wasn't he the... in Laos and then in Vietnam?
Could well be.
Kind of like the CIA chief?
I don't think he'd been that senior. He was still a fairly young guy. I don't think he'd have a senior position.
All right. So, how would you spell Shepley?
S-H-E-P.
S-H-E-P.
L-E-Y. Yeah. But...
okay.
I think Mark Lynch, I know Paul Bobminick, knew John Paul Venn fairly well.
Who
Robert,
did?
Minnick.
Okay.
And the whole AIDS thing and so on, okay? Whole AIDS, you say it, okay? Probably Roger Montgomery would know him, okay? Roger Montgomery was the IBS team leader for the Delta.
So he would have known John Paul Venn, too?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah. But, and what was the, Steve Shepley was the young kid.
Young kid in subterranean problem. Maybe, Minnick may not know about him.
Uh-huh.
Maybe to the extent that he got to Kanta where Minnick was located,
uh-huh.
He might have known him. Maybe heard about him.
Maybe it would be interesting to find, I don't want to see Shepley.
But there's another guy here who's living in Hawaii. Okay, I mentioned that I spent the Tet Offensive in the MACV compound in subterranean. In Basfian province.
Uh-huh.
There
in the compound
was a guy named Eric Herter, who is the grandson of Christian Herter.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And he was IBS?
He was Spec 5 military.
Oh, okay.
Harvard graduate.
Uh-huh.
Bright guy. Working with the Chiu Hoi program, which is the getting the Viet Cong to come out of the,
mm-hmm.
you know, come out of the cold. And repatriate. But he is a poet at heart, and he fell in love with Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And his life has been wrapped around Vietnam in one way or another. He may be in Vietnam right now with his video camera trying to do, you know, documentaries and bring back and so on. But he knew Shepley. He has a lot of stories about Shepley. Just maybe a name down there. What's his name? Eric Herter.
Eric
this is the name of somebody. And he would know us in the IBS there. And. He'd be good for a lot of background on low-level U.S. involvement at the provincial level. You know Nick Thorne, the guy who didn't want to hear about the helicopter raid in Futong Village. The guy who picked me up and took me into the compound and as the Tet Offensive was unfolding.
So
the
he
guy
was the...
who was drunk most of the time. And,
he was the son of Christian Herter?
Yes. No, I think maybe grandson.
Grandson.
Yeah. Who was Eisenhower's Secretary of State.
Yeah.
A name I remember growing up.
Okay. But anyway.
And he's in Hawaii, and if you ever need his address, and well, let's say I want to get a letter to him.
Eric is?
Yeah.
Oh. You mean here in Honolulu or the Big Island?
No, he's over on the other side of this island. Over in what's that place? Ka'ava.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And fascinating. He's 1 year old than I am. you know, grain hair and granny glasses and so on. A romantic, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, probably not on this trip because, you know, I've got one other person to look up.
Weininger?
Paul Iyer.
Paul Iyer, I don't know the gentleman.
Yeah, he was in last year in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
He came in 74 and was only 10 months while Royal Army was in Vientiane, and then 2 months under Pathet Lao, and then told him to leave.
Oh, yeah.
So I've got to get in touch with him, and
then
the following day is my paper, and then flight.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of limited, so I wouldn't be able to drive up to Eric at all, although that might be fun. You know, if one thing I was going to ask, might as well do this now before I get too far. You mentioned two people as being helpful to you. One in language when you first arrived.
Tavantat.
Okay. And then your other friend down in the village in the Delta.
Right.
One thing that both Mark Gilbert, the other fellow who's involved in this, and I are trying. We've sent off another grant application asking if we can get some money to go to both Vietnam and Laos and interview folks who would have known IVSers at that time. Would it be okay to look up either of these people?
To be sure. Especially you might want to just have me right ahead to broach the idea.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because even though things are liberalizing, that doesn't mean that they're always been, and if someone has been in it re-education, you don't want to make anyone suspicious.
You gotta let them,
You know, and if they want to say no,
sure,
they have to be able to say no. And
this turns here, on that very idea. Hey,
and
I'm sorry. Go ahead and get what you want, because the tape ran out. And then
I didn't want to get their names and addresses now, but I wanted to broach this idea.
Sure,
because it all will be moot if we don't get the grant.
Yeah.
You know, we'll know that in a few months.
Yeah.
But if we do get the grant, we're going to be looking to go there in December. And Mark will be mostly staying in Vietnam, although I'm going to spend some time there too. While I'll be mostly spending time in Laos, although he'll be perhaps
back
coming
away,
there too. So, you know, as many contacts as we can get.
Sure.
Not just from you, but from folks in the summer who say, oh, yeah, I was in this village, and so-and-so is, you know, we're beginning to correspond again. You know?
Now, there's another chap.
Because we want to do the complete picture, not just the Americans,
but
also the Laotians and the Vietnamese and what they saw of the.
After I was in the Delta and I was evacuated because of the Tet Offensive, I then was assigned for about a year to a village northwest of Saigon. Called Binh Xuân, which is a Vietnamization of the word Vincent, from Saint Vincent, the patron saint of the Catholic refugees who had settled this province. And they were interesting a lot. They were originally from Nghệ Tinh, central Vietnam.
Just a little north of the division.
Right. They've been refugeed, if you might make a verb.
Did they come down with
about three times? They came down in 55. Mm-hmm. Not with him, at least in the same exodus.
Yeah.
They were placed in Binh Thuy, right? Where they were kicked out of because they're not playing by the rules, by the Viet Cong rules, and so they landed on. And then they settled outside of Saigon. That's where I was involved. Now, I went in to replace another IVS volunteer, and he's a character. He's one of those guys I mentioned earlier who knew a great deal and just wouldn't keep quiet. And it turns out he was pretty well informed, but he was strident, he was sanctimonious, and all the things we mentioned. His name is Herb Roos. Okay.
Herb Ruth.
Roos. If you like, you can just jot that name down as somebody.
Yeah.
Okay. Whether you can.
Okay.
H-E-R-B.
Yeah.
Okay. R-U-H-S.
R-U-H-S.
Yeah.
Okay.
Herb Roos. And Minnick knows him very well and so on.
Okay.
Yeah. But he would be a colorful informant.
Okay.
Very bright guy.
Yeah.
Just ask him.
All right. He'll tell you. Oh, so what did you do with the refugee village?
In that refugee village, with the priest, and a couple of close collaborators. Okay, we had a level of cooperation which would be the envy of any IBS volunteer in another village. And they're very well organized.
Or even Peace Corps people.
Right. And three things. One, they wanted to finish a pig farm, a facility that my predecessor started. So I was the gopher. I was able to go on the nearby Division One base and find sheet metal and cement and tarpaulins and found somebody to dig a well and so on. And the military was very cooperative. They like to do these sort of things.
Well, they could write it up in a nice report to say how they're winning hearts and minds.
Sure, yeah. And it was a nice change. I mean, they get out to see people.
And that was pretty free of BC, wouldn't it be?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, they were very bitterly anti-communist, very bitterly. And
so they had
their own little village militia, and they would go on patrol around, and they were suspicious of the
patrol. Serious patrol.
They were very suspicious of the neighboring village called Gadsden, named after Gadsden, Texas, that had sponsored this village and sent a lot of aid over to to resettle these refugees.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't Catholics, and therefore they were communists. Okay.
Okay.
That speaks
well. They may have been.
Yeah.
You know.
Anyway, when we got the project finished, then. We got pigs there. That didn't work too well, but another product that worked better is raising chickens. And so I was going back and forth between this village in Saigon, which is about an hour away, getting feed, getting stocks of chickens and so on, little chicks and so on, getting medicines and so on. So I come back and I had a product. A lot of them were able to raise chickens very fast and sell them to middlemen in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
That worked out pretty well. And the last thing I worked on was to build a church. Now, we weren't out there to build churches.
But they're
after me. That was very, very important.
Yeah.
And I kind of cleared it by my superiors in Saigon there is okay. And what we did
which superior?
First it was Danny Whitfield, okay?
Uh-huh.
And I guess I had a normal supervisor for the region 3, but since I was so close to Saigon, I didn't have a scout, so I went straight to the people, Danny Whitfield and Russ Bradford in Saigon.
So you were talking IBS.
Right, IBS, yeah.
Okay.
So it was okay that I helped these people scrounge materials from wherever to build a church, you know?
Okay. I was asking because sometimes the superior might, in a sense, also be AID people.
Okay.
But you were separate from that. So you were going straight to your own organization. Okay.
And I didn't worry about getting clearance. I mean, if USAID was useful and accommodating, well and good. If it wasn't, then I didn't have to see them.
Okay. The best of both worlds. You could have it if you
absolutely,
wanted.
And so we went to back to this junkyard and picked up some materials there and picked up cement things from the military bases and so on. And that village worked hard like you wouldn't believe. Everybody's involved to clear the area and to lay the cement work and to get the things welded up and so on. And when I went back 3 years ago, I saw this church. It was very nice.
Still there.
And I had left before. So
well used.
Yeah. Actually, when peace had come, many people had gone back to where they were, their previous park. Well, I didn't go back north. I went up to Bintwee.
Okay.
And it's in my mind that when I go back there, I'll go back to this refugee village, which is largely empty now, and one of people that recognize the name, I'm going to find out exactly where in Bintwee might be, and I'm going to try and get on a motorcycle and up in it and say, where's Bintwee? Okay. And where's this guy? Also, I want to look at the priest there, who I heard was in retirement.
Uh-huh.
He's probably somewhere near Saigon. He used to walk in and say, hi, how are you doing? And bring a packet of oranges would be interesting. And I could pick up on all intervening stories.
So, but this Was this toward the end of your second year?
Okay, I was in country for half a year until basically April 1967. Okay, I was then by July in 67 down in the Putong village, came where I was for a little over half a year until the Tet Offensive.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I was evacuated to Saigon, okay, March, April, and maybe by May or June I was in this refugee village, doing the project you just mentioned, this Catholic refugee village. And then around Christmas I went on, of 68, I went on home leave. I came back. I was in the village again briefly until, let's say, May or so. And then I went down and did this project, orienting new volunteers in Bosnian province.
Right,
and where I got
right.
back to see the scouts
yeah.
at the stores there.
Yeah.
And then after I finished that, I was told that I asked if I wanted to be the coordinator for the more than half the country, kind of the team leader that Sabina talked about.
Yeah, yeah, because okay. she mentioned that you guys met first when you were team leader up there.
So
but that was in your second year? Or
second tour.
Right. So there was no break between the second tour? First and second?
Yeah, I was on home leave.
That was the home
leave. For Christmas 68. And I was there on home leave to watch our good buddy on January 20th take the oath of inaugural oath.
Say, I'm not going to come back here.
Yeah, yeah. And so after that, I went back again on leave.
Okay.
For about another, until August 1970. And basically the second tour, briefly with the project in Boston, orienting volunteers, mostly as team leader. And then I ranged from all of the second half of the country, top half of the country, and I saw some
really?
Things, yeah.
You know, so all the way from the 17th parallel down to at least Dalat.
Right, Dalat, and below Dalat was Balop.
Okay.
Which is the capital of Lumdum province then. And then you keep on going down the road, you go like the Saigon.
Yeah. So what did a team leader
basically
do?
Basically just go visit and just try to understand what they're doing.
Uh-huh.
And basically you see if they're healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Almost always were.
See physically as well as mentally and, you know, if they're down in the dumps.
Right. Yeah. If they, like Sabina had this guy trying to jump her bones here, Indian volunteer. And he wanted to get the hell off and try to go up there and...
Indian, you mean from South Asia, India?
Right, right, right.
Okay.
And, you know, do they need anything? Do they need duck? Do they need chicken stock? Do they need seeds? What have you?
Mm-hmm.
I could, you know, try to fill orders from my location and stop trying. And then I just simply in a position to write memos and so on and tell people in Saigon what was going on. Once a month I would then go down to Saigon for team meetings and so on. And I went to Balop, Dalat, Panrang. Jay, put the name, that's the guy, the international, Jay somebody. Jay Scarborough, there he is.
Is what?
That's the guy who's in Panrang. Okay, the guy, the chow man.
Oh, for the chow, okay.
Jay Scarborough.
Scarborough?
Yeah, S-C-A-R-B-O-R-U-G-H.
Okay, good.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, that's... popped right back in.
Right. That's good. And then Tracy Atwood in Terrell Fubon, which is a real backwater, where he worked with the Jirai tribe. I went up to Hue once or twice to visit John Schaefer, who's now professor of English somewhere in Michigan, maybe University of Michigan.
I think you had mentioned him before.
No. John Schaefer. Another poet, we could see the poetic side of Vietnam. Married a Vietnamese girl, who happened to be a teacher in Cong Tri when we were there.
Uh-huh.
And he was a teacher who was much admired by my Gary Cock, the other artist volunteer, who was teaching English at the same high school. She was a co-teacher. Oh, Miss Quinn, what a lovely lady, and so on. It turns out John Schaefer married her.
And he was talking about how nice she was,
yeah.
And so well, I mean, doesn't that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
and you thought nothing was going on, huh?
All power to him.
Yeah.
See, but okay. So I did those parts, and so it was the pig farm, He was the chicken raising plus building the church and so on. And a lot of scrounging around Saigon. I had a had a 2.5-ton truck, a Korean vintage, sort of rounded nose, something called Eisenhower truck, I'm not sure. I used to drive that through the streets of Saigon. I had a big air horn, air brakes, man. I used to load up with all kinds of scrounged goods. And we'd stop and spend overnight in the Agus compound in Saigon, my collaborator and I. And then a couple of them would go back to our place in Binyong the next day and offload and so on.
The refugee place.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious, though, about your team leader stuff. How many volunteers did you have to lead as a team leader?
Eight or nine.
Okay.
We also had one or two guys in Da Nang.
Okay. That were not under you, or?
Basically, I was just to go listen and do what I could. We didn't have the authority to say, well, you better do this, you better not do that.
Yeah.
Didn't have the moral authority, because we were doing different things, and I couldn't claim agriculture expertise. And I didn't
right,
get that
yeah.
Or English teaching expertise, they were teaching English. It was basically to find out what was going on, and if anything really weird was going on, basically bring it back to Saigon and let them decide if they had to intervene in personnel affairs.
Yeah. So if this
and it was a rich experience for me, because I got to travel, and I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, that would have been great in and of itself. But let's see, I was trying to think, this is a pretty big part of the country,
mm-hmm.
and about nine people only, and then around in Saigon, and then going into the Delta, how many more people would have been in country?
Okay, well, Robert Minnick was in charge of the people in the Delta, and
okay.
They're in Region 3. So this Region 4 is Delta, Region 3 is around Saigon, Region 2 is from kind of like Phan Thiet up to Da Nang, and Region 1, Ikhor they call it, from Da Nang up to the DMZ.
But this isn't your team leader area.
I was team leader of Regions 1 and 2, the northern half.
Okay.
And Minnick was from the southern half.
Okay, 4, and then there would have been another team leader for the Saigon area?
I think just one person, Minnick, for the Delta and the Saigon area. Or Saigon is so close that the people just came in. They didn't have to have somebody go out and see them.
Okay.
So that's all kind of fuzzy at this point.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, well, there might be stuff in the IBS office. So,
hey, getting back to the job of the junior. And while we sort of picked up what's happening in the provinces, we were also responsible to find out and bring back news from Saigon. And a lot of the news was, you know, our relationship with aid, we were going to get private funds, what are we doing with the leadership, you know, IBS leadership in Washington, where were they in this issue and so on. And this is where Mark Lynch could swing in if we get a hold of him. Basically, we hope that we could be, our idea is that we could be more effective if we were clearly independent from the U.S. effort.
Mm-hmm.
Independent from U.S. effort, we had to wean ourselves of USAID funding and go private funding. What were the people in Washington doing towards getting private funding? Some of the other issues, I think, were how we can, again, this is kind of hazy now, how we can increase our expertise. We all learned, as generals, that it was nice to have a presence there. It was a rich experience for us. But without some serious agricultural skills or
some kind of skills,
then our ability to help things was limited.
Uh-huh.
That was a source of concern.
Okay.
Yeah.
What about, there was a time when some people in IVS Vietnam quit,
right,
and tendered their resignation. You would have been there then.
I was there in the meetings with Agon. I see that, and they had big meetings to go the whole issue. And one of those people attended, John Summer, Don Luce, Gene Stoltzfus, and Will Myers? Yeah. Don Luce, Gene Stoltzfus, Will Myers, I'm not sure. Name will come back. About four guys. And just a lot of angst-filled meetings and so on. And these guys quit, and we were supportive. And here's a story.
Stoltzfus quit?
And
Summers? Or you see?
John Summers, he was a facilitator. He'd already been back in the United States. He came back.
Okay.
He was kind of a facilitator for these meetings. He was there at those meetings.
Uh-huh.
But he was
informing, discussing, helping these people decide. I actually have pictures in here of the meetings that people sitting around inside.
Oh, really? Oh, great.
What else there? Anyway, they decided, and there, it was the unspoken request was as many of you as possible join us. I was there, but we all had draft pressures on us. It was a decision that would have consequences.
Yeah, because you'd be exposed as a 1A.
Sure. And I didn't have the courage. I didn't have the courage to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have pretensions that my presence was needed there, or else Vietnam would not have any development, or would not have any comfort. We saw ourselves as very small as we were. But it made a big impression on some Vietnamese that they did that.
When people quit.
Right. This Vietnamese mentor of mine in Phu Tham Village, yeah, who spent so much time, I've referred to some time before, he asked me to introduce him to Don Lee. And so I came up with him one time from Sub Trang. We went out and we
with
met Don Lee and so on. And they talked far into the night.
Really?
Far into the night. And he was so impressed. And he knew that they'd written a book, and he could tell by talking with them and these other people. He met some other guys, and he was so impressed that these Americans had understood so much and had such, such conscience that they'd be willing to take the message to the American people. Had some risk to themselves. One risk of, maybe being government going after them, drafting them, or harassing them in some unidentified way. Risk of just taking a lot of flack from those in the United States who were supporting the war.
Social ostracism. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that was a warm, fuzzy moment for me.
Yeah.
As people got together, discussed the war and how to bring it to an end. Remember, as I left Vietnam, I said, go back there. Do what you can. I had people invite me from a noodle stand in intersection Saigon back to the house. Once they saw I could speak Vietnamese, we'd talk for a while, and they made their assessment of who I was and so on. They invited me back to talk about the war. What could they tell me, and if I could then relay to people at home in America? It happened most other times that people would say, oh, please, let me talk to you. You know, they saw me as a conduit. And I tried to do that in my own way. I did not. When I got back, I did join a chap from the FCNL, Friends Committee on National Legislation, and got a response that were called Civilian Perspective into China, where we got a lot of the obvious volunteers, people from other organizations who'd been in Vietnam as civilians, who had been there a long time, spoke the language, had worked extensively with people as opposed to living in compounds and bases and so on. And we lobbied the Hill, we went in to see people in state, definitely from the executive branch, I think. People in Congress, to be sure. I'm not sure I've met with any military. It's been a while. And that was my own involvement besides speaking before a couple of church groups and student groups when I was there. But it was...
In this one-month period.
In this one-month period.
That's a busy 1 month.
I'm sorry. No, this is after I got back.
Oh, even after the second. Okay. Okay. Right.
So that was minor compared to what Don Lewis and William Myers and... Stolfus did. They went back and they formed the Indochina Air War Committee. Fred Branfman was there.
Yeah, Branfman.
And
okay.
They went around and city and
national circuits almost. Yeah,
that was truly impressive.
Yeah, yeah. But still, I mean, that it wasn't just one. But what you just said about even Vietnamese pulling you over, and as individuals, not as party members or anything like that, saying, please tell your countrymen.
And I was back a few years ago. They would say, please go back and tell them to break the embargo.
Yeah.
Okay, they wanted contact with America. They wanted just, cultural contact. They wanted technical contact. They wanted trade. So Americans, we're trading with Japan and Korea and Taiwan. Come on, get with it. We trade. These are people who had been Viet Cong during the war.
Yeah, yeah.
They were in the tunnels of Cu Chi, this one guy, the doctor, tunnels of Cu Chi, treating wounded Viet Cong. This is a perfect example how people who've been adversaries could come around and wherever they got it, maybe it's Ho Chi Minh, were simply willing to let bygones be bygones, willing to exchange ideas with somebody, and perhaps because introduced through this friend of mine, his mentor.
Yeah.
Plus, you know, I could speak the language, which always makes things
right.
easier. For a reason, and then they you know, just sort of very quickly pour, and said, you know, I'll do this. You know, but, it was an honor. It was an honor. I was stoked. I was with people of great minds,
mm-hmm. you know,
of great morality.
Yeah.
In my view.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You could take the position.
Yeah, and yeah, kind of tough positions.